Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be talking about the final score by Star Trek 2 and 3 composer James Horner, The Magnificent Seven. So, this is a movie which came out last week, and it was directed by Antoine Fuqua, who is one of my all-time favorites, and it was written...
Training Day. Everybody knows him from Training Day.
Yes.
There's your easy get right there.
And The Replacement Killers. The Replacement Killers.
I would argue Training Day probably more on everybody's minds.
It absolutely is on everybody's mind. But for me, this is one of those guys, one of those very few guys where I feel like I found him on day one and he hit a chord with me and I was there through the hard times. And then when he hit it big, I was like, I was there first. I've been saying forever. Anyway, so I'm with him till the very end. And he directed this movie and it was written by a guy who collaborates with him a lot, Richard Wank, and Nick Pizzolatto, who is the creator of True Detective, which is very, very good. And it stars Denzel Washington. And it's a remake of two movies, Seven Samurai by Akira Kurosawa and The Magnificent Seven by John Sturges.
Yes.
So you want to give a synopsis of this thing?
A robber baron in the West, in ye old West, as we like to call it, is taking advantage of a town and is basically giving everybody the ultimatum to either take his paltry payout for their farmland or die. And so they go out and they reach Denzel Washington, and he puts together a group of seven that is going to help the town defend itself from these brigands, this army of ne'er-do-wells that have come to threaten their existence. And so the whole movie is basically, you know, it's a good old classic Western sort of thing where it's like, you know, the heroes come into town, they, you know, help train the town, and, you know, it all builds toward a big explosive conclusion, you know, sort of, you know, the way the Wild Bunch does, or the original Magnificent Seven, or, you know, it's very much a thing about the Western to build toward that big climactic showdown.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the original, Seven Samurai is considered by many to be one of the greatest films ever made.
It is.
And The Magnificent Seven, the original, is considered by many to be one of the greatest Westerns ever made.
It is considered that. You're right.
And, you know, here's the remake. So what did you think about it?
I enjoyed it. I will preface it by saying that for me, and I'm adapting a line about Shakespeare that a friend of mine relayed to me in college, but for me, Westerns are like pizza. When they're good, they are so good. And when they're bad, they're still good. Like, for me to dislike a Western, you have to screw it up so spectacularly that it's just nigh unwatchable. Right. I love everything about Westerns. I don't know where I got it from specifically. I think possibly my dad, because my dad loved Westerns. And so I enjoyed this a great deal. I had fun from beginning to finish. I had no, you know, misconception about it. I knew, you know, it was going to be just, you know, fun ride, and I knew where it was going, and that it was a remake. So it gave me what I wanted. Were I to judge it with a more stringent critical eye, I would probably take certain pieces of it apart. I would probably question some of the editing, that sort of thing. But overall, I was happy with it. I didn't regret shelling out the money, you know, to get away from the kids for the night and drag my wife to go see it. What did you think?
My dad as well, a huge fan of this movie. I remember watching this as a kid you know, it came on TV one day or whatever, and he's like, oh my God, this movie's so great, you have to watch it. Which my dad does not watch anything. Like, you know, only two movies he's ever seen are Magnificent Seven and Charade. So there you go. But you know, I definitely was familiar with the source material, you know, going into this, and as sort of a lead up to it, I watched Seven Samurai and the original Magnificent Seven. I'm ashamed to say I had never seen Seven Samurai before.
And you know, given your history, I'm very surprised by that. That would seem to be, you know, something that at some point would have been forced upon you. Like, you would have been tied down like, you know, McDowell in A Clockwork Orange and forced to watch it.
I think because of the running time, 3 hours and 26 minutes, I think that's why they didn't show that to us in the history of cinema at the good old film school. Instead, the Kurosawa movie, which they did show us, was Rashomon, which is substantially shorter. But very, very good. And yeah, I don't know. I had just never gotten around to it. But I did watch it along with The Magnificent Seven. So, you know, going into it, I guess I had seen variations on this theme like a lot, you know, like in the days leading up. And, you know, like I said, you know, Antoine Fuqua, I was there, you know, Replacement Killers blew my mind when I saw it, you know, opening weekend. And I have sworn to watch every single Fuqua movie, you know, at the very first show on opening day ever since. And I have, even Lightning in a Bottle, his blues concert film. I've been there, you know, at the very beginning. I love that guy. I love him so much. And because of that, and because it was written by Nick Pizzolatto, who created True Detective, which I think is like one of the smartest shows I've ever seen. You know, I watched that show, and the writing is so good that I just feel like, you know, I'm getting smarter as I watch it. You know.
Okay.
I was really, really, really looking forward to this movie. You know, and yeah. I have to say that I was disappointed.
Okay.
I think that, you know, maybe I would have liked it more if I hadn't just watched the originals right before it. But what that really pointed out to me were the differences and some of the choices which were made in this one. And for the most part, I thought the choices that were made were not good. In particular, the one that stands out to me, unfortunately, is a spoiler. It's the end of the movie. But I won't ruin it, okay? There's a little itty-bitty bit of a twist. But what I will say, and this is regardless of the ending, although it does play into it, if you look at Seven Samurai, one of the things which really struck me while I was watching that movie was how the bad guys are basically not present. They are nameless, faceless beings.
Right.
And that really kind of stood out to me because you hear a lot about, you know, these superhero movies or Star Trek movies or whatever, and people saying, like, the villain is terrible. They didn't do a good job with the villain. And my thought has always been, like, well, you don't really need a good villain if the focus is on, let's say, the good guys, you know, or whatever, and it's more about that. And, you know, Seven Samurai really kind of, you know, spoke to me on that level. It's not about there being a villain. It's not about them taking down, you know, this person who's really, really evil. It's about them dealing with a threat. It's what it shifts the focus much more to them helping people out than it is to them defeating a villain. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you know, there seems to be some villain creep going on as this thing gets remade, and you do have, you know, like a face of the villains in the original Magnificent Seven, and in this one you've got a straight up bad guy, and there's a bit of a twist at the end. And all I'll say about that is I feel like the twist at the end, I mean, it's not even really a twist, it's just
it's not really a twist. It completes an arc that is left very vague up to that point. And it's what I will grant you is that the revelation of, because you do go through the movie and you're like, oh, okay, all right, I'm intrigued. all right, I need a little more information. They keep referencing this. And then the reveal is kind of, oh, okay. You know, it's not a, they spent maybe a little bit too much climactic focus on it. And it would have been better revealed earlier instead of having the full reveal at that moment.
Yeah. But even that, like, if it were any other movie, or if I hadn't seen the originals, I wouldn't think anything of it, because it's just the thing that happens in movies. It's the thing that you do. But what it's doing, what it's trying to do, I think, is give character motivation to the protagonist. And I think that that's kind of a shame, because it makes the protagonist less altruistic than he should be. You know, one of the things about these original movies is it's like these are good guys who they're going into a situation where, you know, the town, they have nothing to offer. All they have to offer is, you know, like, you know, we need help and we'll feed you. That's all they have to offer. There's nothing that the good guys are going to be getting out of this deal, aside from the satisfaction that they know that they, you know, basically saved these people's lives, you know, saved this village. And here, you know, it cheapens that, because there's other motivation at play.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I think that there was definitely a missed opportunity to make these characters more heroic. And I agree with you that, especially in the context of a Western, I prefer my heroic arcs very heroic, as opposed to more self-serving. But this is very much a movie where, looking back on it, I think I detect a very heavy editing hand. I think that there's a cut of this movie that addresses all of our concerns, and I can't judge the movie based on that cut, and I'm not going to judge the movie based on that cut. But I hope they release an extended version, because I would love to see that. I would love to see that. Because especially with Goodnight Robichaux, there's actually a great moment that speaks to a lot of the sentiments of racial disharmony going on right now. And I think it's, you know, there are some very relevant moments with him and Denzel Washington, with Ethan Hawke and Denzel Washington that speak to that. And I feel like it was more fleshed out in another cut of this movie. Although I always wonder with, you know, the shorter and the longer cuts, how that works for the score. Like, do they score the entire, you know, if they have a 3-hour version and they score it, how do they resolve that to release the 2-hour and 12-minute version I just sat through, you know?
Yeah. I think lots of times they end up reusing, you know, pieces or whatever. Or there is no score in those sections. Maybe, you know, there are little bits that they throw in here and there. You know, it's, I think it depends, you know, situation by situation. And this situation is certainly weird in terms of that, because of how this score was crafted. Now, okay, James Horner, as everyone knows, passed away last year, right before the release of Antoine Fuqua's last movie, Southpaw, which Horner did the score for as well. And Fuqua was shooting The Magnificent Seven, and Horner had apparently recorded about 15 minutes worth of music, because he was trying to get ahead of the game, because he had like a million projects coming up in the near future. So he had actually had this stuff, you know, written, and his assistant, one of his collaborators, found it, and unbeknownst to Fuqua, hired an orchestra of sorts, or a number of musicians, to record this music so that Fuqua could hear it and hopefully use it in the movie. Is that right?
Yeah. Horner had worked out a number of the cues. He had a copy of the script, and he was trying to figure out, you know, how much of the original Bernstein score was he going to use? You know, what was he going to do for different themes for, you know, these different moments. And so he had worked this stuff out, And like you said, after his death, it was discovered. And so they put it together. And it's actually very, very touching sort of story because, you know, as you alluded, like Fuqua had a relationship with Horner beforehand. So they presented it to Fuqua and they said, you know, this is a present from James. He had done this. And they decided as they were going forward that the best way to honor him and his memory and their friendship with him and that sort of thing was to take what he had worked out and expand it and just, you know, run with it and say, you know, we know James, we knew James, we hear what he's working on here. How do we think it would have, you know, blossomed out from that point? And I mean, listening to the score during the film, the music works very well, I think. And then listening to the score independent of the film works really well. It sounds like a James Horner score. Not as precisely as like if I'm sitting down and listening to Willow, but or Star Trek II or Aliens. But it definitely sounds like Horner. There's this one horn, and I'm probably misusing the term. So if Brandon Matala over on Melodic Treks, if I'm misusing a term, please don't hurt me. But there's a horn scale that he uses that's definitely a Horner signature. If you listen to any one of his scores, you hear it in there. And it is all throughout this at the tense moments. And I'm like, ah, there, that is a James Horner score right there. I agree with you. It is very fascinating that they went ahead and they plugged forward with what they had worked out. And they said, you know, hats off to them for taking 15 minutes and turning it into, you know, 100 and whatever minutes of music that they produced.
Yeah, for sure. The other composer on the project was Simon Franklin.
Yes.
Who put together the stuff. And it is interesting because, yeah, I mean, you definitely hear, you know, there's these themes at play which sound very Horner-esque. I mean, Horner is kind of known for, you know, maybe you could say recycling some things and putting them in.
Williams does the same thing, man. So it's
AD
all good.
AD does the same thing, but Horner, I think, takes it to another level at times. And, you know, you could hear some of that. I heard a lot of Titanic in here. I heard a lot of Clear and Present Danger in here, actually.
Really?
Which is kind of strange.
I'll have to go back. I'll have to go back and listen to that because there was, I will say there were points where I was like, I don't quite know where that, you know, like. But it triggered. I was like, that's somewhere. I know what this is. Okay. I'll have to go back and listen to that.
I just think it's so cool how like all of his collaborators and everything just sort of like came together. Like it was still his team.
Yeah.
It's like the only person who was missing from the team was him, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool how they were like, let's just do this one more time, you know? And go out with a bang, you know, in a sense. And
literally.
And I think that's really cool that they were able to do that, you know.
Well, and the nicest thing, too, was that they did go ahead there's an interview with Franklin over on Collider that is really interesting because they, you know, they point blank ask, like, how do you go into making a score? Because regardless of what you think of the film, the original film, Magnificent Seven, the score is iconic. Even if you don't know, even if I say to you, hey, that, you know, the overture from Magnificent Seven by Bernstein, it's terrific. And even if you looked at me and you said, I don't think I've ever heard it, and I played it for you, you'd say, oh, that. Oh, yeah, I know that. Like, it's that iconic. It is a part of the audio landscape. And he very specifically addressed like the challenge of deciding how much of that were we going to work in and pay homage to, because you can't escape it. It's impossible to get away from it. And he used a different example, but for me, it would be like watching a Superman movie without, you know, Williams's, you know, overture is kind of like, oh, well, okay. Like, it's so, like, I don't know how you can dodge it, you know? Like, it's so, such a Herculean task to operate within that shadow. I think they found a good balance, personally, but.
Yeah, you know, I mean, like you're saying, it definitely is something which is not. I mean, like, you know, as someone who had only seen the original, I think probably once or twice, you know, years and years ago, and then saw it again, like last week. As soon as the theme started up in my rewatch, I was like, oh, I feel like I'm at Disney World. I feel like I'm at Hollywood Studios. You know. Yep. Yep. And because you hear that all the time, you know, over there, and it is such a big part of movies. And it's, I was curious if they would use it in this movie because, you know, you've got a lot of balls that you're juggling, you know, yep. You're trying to pay homage to James Horner's work. You're trying to, you know, write a score, and then also you have to deal with this thing. And yep. It's really not present throughout the movie until you get to the end credits, and then that's the theme that they use, you know, for
yeah, but there are little hints of it here and there sprinkled throughout, but they're very subtly worked in there. Like it's almost like the way Ottman approached using Williams for Superman Returns, like outside of using the overture, like there are little hints here and there through it.
Yeah. And you know, I didn't pick up on any of those until I was listening to the score on its own, you know, which if anyone does want to listen to the score, it's on at least Apple Music. And is it on Spotify?
It is on Spotify. Yeah, that's how I've been listening to it.
Right. So most of the music streaming services, you can take a listen for yourself, which is really cool. Yeah. It was weird because when it got to the end, like if it were any other situation, I think, you know, when I heard that song or that piece of music, you know, over the end credits, I would have been like, yeah, you know, and it like works really well. But like in this specific instance, and maybe I wouldn't have even thought about it if we weren't doing this show, but I just kind of felt like, well, that's kind of a bummer. Because, you know, they were using these themes that Horner created, and now here it is, you know, this is like Horner's final work, and in the big, you know, theme piece at the end of the movie, we're hearing something which is, you know, 50 years old.
The thing that I think is unfortunate about its use, keep in mind when it struck up in the theater, like I had a big smile on my face. I was like, yeah, the Magnificent Seven. Yeah. But to speak to your point, when when we were discussing the film, Bernstein's score is for an heroic set of people, and these people are not. And so the music, it's great to have that over the end credits, but it doesn't fit these characters. You know, like this music does not belong to them because they're not. I mean, some of these people are terrible people and they don't even, you know, like, you know, there's like you said, there's no altruistic motivation for them. There's no sort of like moment in the final cut that we get where you're like, oh, yeah, they're OK after all. Like some of the people you're like, you kind of deserved your ending here. You know, like it's one of those things where I think that the unfortunate truth is that as much as I might have enjoyed, you know, the remake, and I do enjoy it, Bernstein's music doesn't belong to these characters. And so I think that's the misstep in terms of the final credits.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that for sure. You know, I don't know. On the whole, I was disappointed. I feel like I need to see it again. You know, because anytime a Fuqua movie comes out that I don't, you know, 100% love, I'm kind of like, what did I do wrong? You
know? Why don't you love me anymore?
So yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know. I feel like I need to give it another shot. Like my big plan was, I'm like, I'm going to take my dad to see it, you know, because I think, and then when I watched the movie, I'm like, I don't think he'd like this movie. I don't think he'd be into this.
I took the missus, and she is not a big fan of Westerns, and she actually kept trying to talk me into going to see Sully. And I, you know, I was like, I don't really want to. I was like, I want to see Magnificent Seven. So she was a real sport about it, and she went and she saw it, and she, you know, she wasn't through the to the moon about it, but she enjoyed it. And I'm like, for my wife to come out of a movie and say, yeah, that was pretty good. Like that's high praise, guys. That's like, you know, you really scored it. That's your thumbs up from Siskel right there. So,
Your wife, made the correct call in terms of movie picks.
I will pass that along to her because I got some grief.
I mean, look, here's the thing about Sully. It's not really about anything, but it's really interesting to watch.
All right.
You'll just leave the theater thinking like, you know, wow, that was really interesting to watch. It's kind of like, you know, going on a roller coaster. It's like, that was really interesting to watch. What's it about? Nothing.
So,
nothing at all.
So would you put it in the category of like one of those dramatic reenactments that you might see on TV every so often?
Yeah, okay. Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, there's like some really interesting formal things going on. The photography is gorgeous. The plot is completely manufactured out of nothing and really just exists in order to show, you know, this amazing thing that this guy did in 4 minutes. And now how do we make that into an hour and a half? And, you know, kudos to them for only making it an hour and a half. I really applaud them. But
it seems like it was a merciful choice.
Exactly. I mean, because, you know, the you would think going into it that that's going to be like 2.5 hours long. It's not. It's an hour and a half, which is fantastic. But if you want to see a Sully that means it, to bring it back full circle here, check out Flight starring Denzel Washington.
Oh, my gosh, yes. That is one of my, you know what, you may recall, that is one of my favorite films of the 21st century so far.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I adore Flight. That is a magnificent film. Absolutely magnificent, just top to bottom.
Yeah, it is. It is. I rewatched that after seeing Sully. Like, I went to see Sully with my wife, and she's like, "That was good." And I'm like, "You got to see Flight." And,
yeah. And awesome. It does. You know, and I will say that for anybody like myself that despises flying and is terrified through the entire thing, the key sequence of Flight, the event upon which everything revolves. It's terrifying. It's truly, I had my palms were sweating. I was pale. I was watching this movie going, why did I do this to myself? But it pays off. It's well worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife's the same way. She's like, why are you showing this to me? I've got to get on a plane in November. I'm like, oh, well, you know, sorry.
Yep.
Oh, well. And one final thing that I want to just say about this, just because whatever. This movie was photographed by Mauro Fiore, who has done a lot of stuff for Antoine Fuqua, including Training Day. He's also won the Oscar for Avatar. He's a graduate of Columbia College Chicago, which I went to. And yeah, it looks really, really good.
I agree. It is gorgeous. And thankfully, because we are Trek fans and because we've talked about it, every time there was a lens flare, I was like, lens flare.
Yep. Yep. That's Fuqua. He shoots an anamorphic just like you're supposed to. So,
as God intended.
Any final thoughts on Magnificent Seven or Horner's score?
I think that both are good. I do. I think Magnificent Seven, if you're looking for something where you can just sort of like unplug and have some entertainment that isn't going to tax you too much in the thinking department, has some good performances and a good score, you know, I'd say go see Magnificent Seven. I don't know what else I'd steer people toward right now.
Yeah, well, Sully. I'd go with Sully. Actually, I probably wouldn't go with Sully, but Sully is a good choice. Anyway, I didn't tremendously like it. I was definitely on the fence about it. There was a lot of stuff about it which I did like the lead up, I guess. But I kind of lost interest, you know, halfway in, and I definitely did not like the ending. As far as the score is concerned, I think, you know, it doesn't really stand out to me as being something special, musically speaking, but I think, you know, the effort that that this team sort of put into creating this score and the reason why they did it is really, really cool. And I'm really glad that it exists in the form that it does today. Yeah. So yeah, there you go. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about the Magnificent Seven today, but that's not all we're talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I've seen some people panicking. Oh my God, the Andorians are now going to be purple and the Tellarites won't be pigs. They'll be aardvarks. You know,
no, that
whatever.
Would be oh, great no, if they were aardvarks.
That would be Talaxians. Yeah.
Standard orbit.
My greatest joy is hearing from those fans who have read the book and said, I feel like I know him now. Thank you so much for that. I always thought he was a good man, but now I know he was a good man. And he was somebody to, you know, look for a role model and try to be that kind of a role model to other people.
Saturday Morning Trek.
I try to see it how a kid would see it when they were watching this for the first time in 1973. It's not that if the devil's not real, so God isn't real. It's, no, the devil's real, and he's actually kind of cool, and maybe we should help him out a little bit? That's the way I kind of think it. And I think that's even more transgressive than any sort of statement on whether or not the devil truly exists.
Melodic Treks.
Charlie's our new darling, our darling, our darling. Charlie is my darling, and I love that.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, you name it, we're there. All right, before we go, we need to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau. Thank you very much for your support.
Thank you.
And if you want to be like Norm, Chris, and Jeff, head on over to Patreon. Patreon.com/TrekFM, to be precise. That's patreon.com/TrekFM, which is our website where you can donate and help us keep the network going. If you go there, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. So head on over to patreon.com/TrekFM. Check it out. Join the team, and we really appreciate your support. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, and you can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field in Facebook, and check it out. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Kessel Junkie, on your social network of choice. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. Or you can find me over on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing on the Nerd Party Network. And Mike, where can they find you?
You can find me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, Trek FM's daily rewatch of Star Trek. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, that's it for September, so you know what next month is.
Why, yes, I do, Michael. It's Shocktober.
Yeah, although thinking about it, I'm like, maybe we should have done Spocktober, but that's not nearly as fun.
Man, now you took all of the fun out of Shocktober for me, Mike.
No. Shocktober is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be looking at a lot of horror things.
Yeah, we are. It's going to be pretty great.
And we're going to get things kicked off next week by looking at the Twilight Zone movie, as well as the episodes of the Twilight Zone, which the Twilight Zone movie was based on.
Yeah.
All of which were written by Star Trek people.